I remember that fall semester like it was yesterday. The crisp air on campus, the leaves turning orange and gold, the constant buzz of dorm life at my small liberal arts college in the Midwest. I was 18, fresh out of high school, and still figuring out who I was. It was mostly girls on my floor in my dorm, a tight-knit group of us who bonded over late-night study sessions, bad cafeteria food, and endless gossip about boys, classes, and our futures. That's where I met him. Online, of course. Back then, in the early 2000s, chat rooms and forums were our social media. There was this site for music lovers, where we talk about indie bands, share playlists, and vent about life. His username was something lame like Ghostwriter24, but he was hilarious in the group chats. He'd crack jokes about everything from politics to pop culture, always with this witty edge that made me laugh out loud. He lived in North Carolina, he said, working some entry-level job, but he dreamed of being a writer. We started private messaging after a while. Nothing flirty at first, just sharing stories. He knew all my friends from the dorm, too, since we'd all joined the forum together. Looking back, the fact that he mostly chatted with us girls should have been a warning sign. But I was naive. Hell, we all were. We thought the internet was this magical place where you could make real friends without the awkwardness of real life. A couple of months in, he mentioned he was coming to our state for his cousin's wedding. Hey, it's only a few hours' drive from your campus. What if I swung by? Meet the crew in person, he typed one night. I'd never met anyone from online before, but the idea excited me. He seemed so genuine, so funny.
Oh my god, yes! You can crash at my dorm. My roommate's always at her boyfriend's place anyway,
I replied. The girls were pumped too. We spent days planning, pizza from the local joint, maybe a bonfire if the weather held, and just hanging out in the common room.
Well, is he cute?
My friend Sarah asked one afternoon, sprawled on my bed with a bag of chips.
I don't really know,
I admitted, scrolling through our messages on my clunky desktop computer.
I mean, he doesn't have pics up, but who cares? He's hilarious.
Yeah, but what if he's, like, old or something?
Jess chimed in from her desk, twirling her hair. She was the cautious one in our group.
He's 24. That's not old, and he's cool. Stop being paranoid, I said defensively.
The day he arrived, I was a bundle of nerves. I changed outfits 3 times, settled on jeans and a cute sweater. Nothing too try-hard. The wedding was that morning, so he showed up around lunchtime, pulling into the visitor lot. I waved from the steps, my friends flanking me like a welcoming committee. He stepped out, and my stomach dropped. He didn't look 24. Pale skin stretched tight over sharp bones, like he'd been sick for months. His hair was this stringy, greasy blonde mess, thinning on top so you could see patches of scalp. He wore baggy jeans and a faded band tee that hung off his frame.
Hey, ladies,
he called. He went straight for hugs, long, lingering ones that made me stiffen. His arms were bony, and he smelled like stale cigarettes and cheap cologne.
Hi, I'm Emily. This is Sarah, Jess, and Mia.
He grinned, revealing yellow teeth.
Man, you're all even prettier in person. Emily, that sweater brings out your eyes.
We all exchanged glances, but I forced a smile.
Thanks. Come on, let's grab some food.
We headed to the cafeteria first, standard college fare, soggy fries and mystery meat. He piled his tray high, talking nonstop.
So, Emily, you still seeing that guy from your psych class? The one you said was a total douche?
I blinked, caught off guard. I'd mentioned that in a private message weeks ago.
Oh, no, that fizzled out.
Good, he said, winking. You deserve better. Someone mature.
Sarah shot me a look across the table, her eyebrows raised.
So, what do you do exactly, Ghost Rider?
She asked, using his username like a joke.
You can call me Derek. I repair things. It's boring stuff, but hey, it pays the bills. What about you girls? Any boyfriends? Spill the tea.
Mia shifted uncomfortably.
I'm single, focusing on school. Oh, come on. A hot girl like you? Bet you've got stories. Ever hooked up with someone older? It's way better. Trust me.
Derek pressed, leaning forward. The table went quiet. I felt my cheeks burn.
Let's change the subject. How was the wedding?
He shrugged, launching into a story about his family. But even that felt off. He was complaining about his ex who didn't appreciate him, and how women these days were too picky. We nodded politely, but the vibe was souring fast. Back at the dorm, we crammed into the common room. Me, the girls, and a couple of guys from down the hall who'd heard about our visitor. Derek plopped down on the couch next to me.
This place is awesome. Reminds me of my college days. Partied hard back then, he said. You went to college?
Jess asked skeptically.
Yeah, dropped out junior year. Life got in the way. Hey, Emily, you're quiet. What's on your mind? You alright?
He turned to me.
I'm fine.
I lied, forcing a laugh. But inside, I was freaking out. His questions kept coming, probing ones.
Sarah, you mentioned your parents' divorce. That must have been rough. Ever talk to a therapist about it?
Sarah's eyes widened.
How do you know about that? You posted it in the forum once. I remember everything, he said casually.
Creepy. That's the only word for it. He commented on Mia's outfit.
That skirt shows off the best part about you.
And asked Jess if she was still experimenting with girls, referencing some offhand joke she made online months ago. The guys in the room started side-eyeing him, and one even whispered to me. Hey, this dude's kind of weird. You sure about him staying? But the guys eventually got bored and left after a while. As the evening wore on, we tried games, Uno, then Truth or Dare. Derek dared Mia to sit on his lap, just for fun. She laughed it off, but declined. Then he turned to me during Truth.
Emily, what's your wildest fantasy? Be honest.
I froze.
Pass.
I said, my voice shaky.
Ah, don't be shy, Emily. We're all friends here.
He coaxed. I excused myself to the bathroom, splashing water on my face. When I came back, he was telling a story about his crazy ex who'd accused him of stalking. There were red flags everywhere. Night fell, and everyone dispersed. Derek followed me to my room, a tiny space with bunk beds and posters on the walls.
So, this is it. It's cozy. We can share the bed, right? Don't worry, I don't bite. Unless you want me to,
he said, eyeing the twin bed. My skin crawled.
Actually, I hurt my back last week in yoga. Sleeping on the floor helps. You take the bed.
I lied quickly. He frowned, sitting on the edge.
Come on, Emily. It's tiny, but we can cuddle. It'll be fun. No, I'm good down here,
I said firmly, grabbing a blanket and pillow. He sighed dramatically.
Fine, but if you change your mind...
I didn't. I lay there on the hard carpet, staring at the ceiling, heart pounding. He talked for what felt like hours, about his life, his dreams, how he felt a connection with me.
You're special, Emily. Not like those other girls.
I pretended to fall asleep, but I barely closed my eyes all night. Every creak, every breath from above made me tense. Morning couldn't come fast enough. He left early, hugging me too tight again.
We should do this more often. Maybe you visit me next,
he said. Yeah, maybe. I mumbled, waving as he drove off. As soon as he was gone, I burst into tears in front of my friends.
That was the creepiest night of my life,
I confessed. Sarah hugged me.
We all felt it. Never again.
I blocked him online that day. No more messages. No more forum chats. I lived a blessed life. My father gave me everything I ever wanted, including a beautiful seaside villa. I lived in total luxury, working from home for my father's company and enjoying the beauty around me. The only problem was that I didn't have anyone to share it with. The villa was quite isolated, connected to the nearest town by a single winding road along the coast. No one ever passed by, and my childhood friends seldom bothered to make the long trip to see me. It was hard to live in paradise and still feel so alone. So when my father told me that David was going to stay with me for a few weeks in the fall, I was beyond happy. David was the son of my father's best friend. The last time I saw him, we were both 8. I had the biggest crush on him back then, and I wondered what he was like as an adult. Dad told me over the phone that David would arrive by a rental car on November 23rd. He was helping Dad with his finances, and since most of his records were stored at the villa, it was easier for David to do everything here. I anxiously awaited his arrival. He was supposed to reach the villa by the evening, but he didn't come. I knew he wasn't lost, because there's only one road to my property. I didn't have David's number, so I couldn't call him, and I didn't want to bother Dad when it was already getting late. So I went to bed and hoped that I'd see David in the morning. Just past midnight, I awoke to the sound of a car parking outside. I was instantly wide awake. I rushed to the door and saw David get out of his car. He was so handsome. I recognized his dark eyes and curly hair, but I was surprised by just how dashing he'd become since childhood. He was tall and quite muscular. He moved with confidence. I ran downstairs and let him in. The staff that kept my villa running went home in the night, so I was the only one to greet him.
Sarah, you're just as beautiful as I remember.
My heart melted. He apologized for being so late. He said there was trouble on the road, but he wouldn't let anything stop him from coming here. We didn't sleep that night. We spent hours talking about our lives, about the shared memories of our past, and how great it was to see each other. I know it sounds fast, but I was falling in love with him. The next morning, David convinced me to let the servants take a week off. He said it would be better if we had the privacy to reconnect. And he was right. For the next 3 days, I spent every moment with David. I showed him every inch of the villa, and through his eyes, he made me appreciate what a wonderful place it was. We swam in the ocean. We cooked meals together. We shared hidden desires. The nights were so passionate. We hardly slept. I stopped contacting other people and took a break from my job. I even ignored Dad's multiple text messages, probably wanting to check up on how David was doing with his work. My life revolved around David, and because he was still planning to leave after a few weeks, I wanted to have him all to myself, no distractions. A week later, David told me it was time for him to go. It was so abrupt. I expected him to stay at least another week, but he was insistent.
I'd stay forever if I could, but I'll be back, I promise you.
I wished he could be more specific. I didn't want to wait around forever, and I couldn't imagine how lonely the villa would feel once he left. He gave me one final kiss, and then he was gone. I sat on the porch for the longest time, fighting back tears. Eventually, I faced the inevitable and went back inside. I called the servants first, telling them to come back in the morning. Their reactions were a little strange, each one apologizing and asking if I was okay. Then I opened my chat and finally read through my father's messages. None of them made any sense. Something about an accident. Plus, he tried to call me over a dozen times. When I called him back, he sounded broken. His voice was barely a whisper.
The services were nice. I understand why you didn't come. You barely knew him. But still, I wished you were there.
Services? I had no idea what he was talking about. Dad, what happened?
David's funeral, sweetie. God, he was so young.
Dad slowly explained that David had crashed his car on the winding road outside the villa. He skidded off the road and slammed into the ocean. He was dead. I wanted to scream at him. This didn't make any sense. David had left less than an hour ago. If he crashed, then how could they have the time to find the wreckage, ship his body back home, and plan a funeral? Dad, when was David's crash?
November 23rd. He was on his way to see you. I'm so sorry, sweetie. I thought you knew.
I was speechless. And then Dad said something that I'll always remember, word for word.
When you were kids, his father and I always joked that you two were soulmates. One of the reasons I arranged for his visit was because deep down, I knew if you saw him again, you'd fall in love. But I guess that'll never happen.
The phone slipped from my hand, my heart pounding. David had been dead since November 23rd, yet I'd spent a week with him, laughing, loving, living. I stumbled to the porch, staring at the ocean where he'd crashed. A faint scent of his cologne lingered, impossible yet real. Trembling, I whispered his name. The wind carried a soft reply, "I'll be back." Tears fell as I realized our love had defied death itself. Soulmates, Dad had said. I smiled through the pain, knowing David's promise wasn't empty. He'll be back and in this villa. He'd always be with me. In Monticello, Arkansas, the Allen House earned its reputation as one of America's most haunted homes after the tragic death of Liddell Allen in 1948. On Christmas night, she consumed cyanide in her bedroom, later sealed off for nearly four decades. When the room was reopened, investigators found the cyanide bottle and nearly 90 letters hinting at a forbidden romance and heartbreak. After the home was converted into apartments, tenants reported eerie encounters, most notably, the apparition of a woman staring from Liddell's window. The current owners have since uncovered further evidence, deepening the mystery behind Liddell's sorrowful end and the lingering presence within.
I used to work as a waiter at this old hotel up in the Scottish Highlands. The place was called the Glenmurray Inn, tucked away in a misty valley near Loch Ness. Yeah, that Loch Ness. But we didn't talk about the monster much. The locals had their own ghosts to worry about. The hotel was ancient. Built back in the 1700s as a coaching inn, with creaky wooden beams and stone walls that whispered secrets if you listened close enough. It was split into two buildings. The restaurant, where we served up haggis and whiskey to tourists, and the main lodge with the guest rooms. All on the ground floor because, well, Scotland's weather doesn't play nice with stairs. I'd only been there a couple of months, but I'd already heard the stories. The other staff loved spinning yarns during the slow afternoons between lunch and dinner service.
"Which laddie, you didn't ken about the Grey Lady?"
Old Hamish, the bartender, would say, his eyes twinkling over his pint. Hamish was a fixture there, pushing 70 with a beard like Father Christmas gone rogue.
"She was a chambermaid back in the day. Hanged herself in the attic after her lover jilted her. Now she wanders the corridors, headless, some say, in her faded grey dress, silent as the grave."
I laughed it off at first. I'm from Manchester, city boy through and through. Ghosts were for movies and drunk uncles at Christmas. But the place had a vibe, you know? Doors that swung shut on their own, cold spots in the hallways. And once or twice, I'd swear I heard footsteps when I was locking up alone. The owner, Ms. McLeod, a tough old bird with a no-nonsense glare, dismissed it all.
"Superstitious bollocks. Keep the punters coming, though."
She ran the place like a drill sergeant, but she had a soft spot for her regulars, especially these two elderly sisters, the Mrs. Abernathy. They were like a mother of hers from way back. Came every year for a wee holiday. That particular afternoon in July, we had just finished lunch service. Tourists scarfing down salmon and tatties, and things were quiet. I was wiping down tables when Jamie, another waiter, poked his head in from the kitchen. Jamie was a local lad, mid-20s like me, with a cheeky grin and a habit of flirting with anything in a skirt.
"Hey, mate. The Abernathy sisters just pulled up. Boss wants a bottle of claret in their room pronto. They're getting helped out the car, old dears.
You can?
I'll hand to the front. You nip over with the wine."
"No bother," I replied, grabbing a decent bottle from the rack. A 98 Bordeaux. Nothing fancy, but it breathed nice. I uncorked it, set two glasses on a silver tray, and headed out the back door. The courtyard was gravelly, crunching under my shoes, and I caught a glimpse of the two ladies by their old Volvo. One was tall and straight-backed, chatting with Ms. McLeod, while the other, well, she was hunched over, moving slow with a walker. I didn't think much of it. Old age hits hard, right? I nodded politely as I passed, but they were busy with luggage. The main building was empty that time of day. No other guests checked in yet, and the staff were all in the restaurant. I pushed through the side door into the corridor leading to the bedrooms. It was dim in there, even in daylight. The windows were small and leaded, filtering the light like an old sepia photo. That's when the ghost stories crept back into my head. Hamish's voice echoed.
Headless laddie. Shuffle silent-like.
I shook it off, tray balanced in one hand, key in the other for room 7. But as I turned the corner, my heart damn near stopped. There, at the end of the corridor, was a figure. It was facing away, shuffling slowly toward the bedrooms. No head. Seriously, no head. Just a faded gray dress, Victorian style, with a high collar and long skirts, brushing the floor without a sound. The shoulders were rounded, like it was bent from years of sorrow, and it moved with this eerie glide. No footsteps, no rustle. My mind went blank. I froze, tray trembling. Was this it? The Gray Lady? I'd scoffed at the tales, but there she was. Real as the sweat breaking on my forehead. My mouth went dry. I wanted to bolt, but my legs were lead. Then some survival instinct kicked in. I let out this god-awful noise, like a jet engine revving up, half scream, half gasp. The figure stopped, turned slowly, and there was a head. Sort of. It was tucked so low between her shoulders that it was almost invisible from behind. Miss Abernathy, the hunched one, peered up at me with sharp blue eyes. Her face wrinkled like fine leather, but kind. She was tiny, maybe 4 foot something standing. Her spine curved from what I later learned was severe osteoporosis. The dress wasn't Victorian, it was just an old-fashioned wool number, gray from too many washes.
Oh dear, are you all right, young man? You look like you've seen a ghost.
I nearly dropped the tray then, glasses clinking. I, tripped on the carpet. Saved it, though. This is for your room, ma'am. Claret, compliments of Mrs. McLeod. She chuckled softly, adjusting her walker.
How kind. I'm Eliza Abernathy, and that's my sister Agnes out front. We've been coming here for donkey's years. You must be the new lad. Tom, is it?
Tim Hargrove. Sorry about the noise. Clumsy feet. Eliza eyed me skeptically, but let it slide.
Well, Tim, no harm done. Though if you did see something, this place has its secrets. Agnes swears she felt a presence in the night. Cold hands on her shoulder.
I set the tray down inside, pouring a glass to let it breathe. The room was cozy. Twin beds with tartan quilts. A window overlooking the lock. Really? I said, trying to play it cool. I've heard the stories. The Gray Lady?
Oh, aye. Poor soul. They say she was jilted, you know? Hanged herself for love. Women back then, not many choices. But me? I've outlived 2 husbands and a war. Osteoporosis is my ghost now. Bends you till you're half the woman you were.
She sipped the wine, sighing.
Ah, tastes like home. Thank you, dear.
By then, Agnes bustled in. Tall and spry for her age. 80-something, I'd guess.
Eliza, what nonsense are you filling his head with? Don't mind her, Tim. She's always dramatizing. Though that Gray Lady, last year I walked to a shadow at the foot of the bed, whispered my name.
Probably the wind, I muttered, but my pulse was still racing. Ms. McLeod appeared in the doorway, arms crossed.
Tim, stop dawdling. Dinner prep starts in 10.
She turned to the sisters.
Ladies? Settles? Good. Ring if you need anything.
As I left, Eliza caught my arm.
Young man, life's full of tricks. Don't let fear fool you. And if you ever feel alone, well, we're all haunted by something.
That evening, service was busy. Americans, mostly, chattering about castles and kilts. Jamie cornered me in the kitchen.
What happened over there? You looked white as a sheet when you came back.
Thought I saw the ghost. It turned out to be Miss Eliza. Her head so low from the osteoporosis, from behind she looked headless.
Ah, oh, you daft prick. It's classic. Wait till Hamish hears.
Hamish did hear. And by closing time, the whole staff was in stitches.
Larry, you nearly pissed yourself over wee Eliza?
Hugh roared, pulling me a dram.
She's tougher than any spook. Raised 3 barons alone after her man Jan died young. Osteoporosis. Aye, it's a bitch. Eats at your bones like regret. Common in women her age.
I nodded, nursing my whiskey. felt like an idiot. But talking to her, she's got stories. Makes you think about getting old. Ms. McLeod overheard, softening for once.
Those sisters are like family. Eliza's been through hell, lost a child to cancer, buried husbands, but she keeps coming back. That's what haunts this place. Real people, not ghosts.
The Abernathys stayed 3 nights. I chatted with them over breakfasts, Eliza sharing tales of wartime rationing, Agnes joking about modern dating apps.
You lads have it easy,
Agnes said one morning, buttering toast.
Swipe right. In my day, you danced or died alone.
Eliza leaned in.
But beware the jitters, Tim. Like a gray lady. Heartbreak's the real killer.
I remember that summer like it was yesterday. The kind of heat that lingers even after the sun dips behind the Rockies, making everything feel sticky and alive. My roommate had hooked me up with this gig delivering pizzas for a dive called Tony's Pie Shack on the south side of town. The place was a total shithole. Grease-slicked floors that hadn't seen a mop since the 90s, roaches skittering across the counters like they owned the joint, and an oven that belched smoke every time we fired it up. But the tips? They were killer. On a good night, I'd pull in $80 in cash, easy. Enough to make me overlook the sketchy vibes and the fact that I was out there alone until 2 a.m. cruising the dark streets. I wasn't some naive kid. I'd grown up in a rough neighborhood in Denver where you learned quick to trust your gut. But paranoia? Yeah, that was my middle name. I'd binge on true crime podcasts on my drives, the ones about women who vanished on routine errands. So my rule was simple. Drop the pie, grab the tip, ghost. No chit-chat, no stepping foot inside unless absolutely necessary. And if I did, the door stayed cracked open, my keys in hand like a makeshift weapon. It was my second weekend on the job, and I'd already dodged a few weirdos, the drunk frat boys who leered a little too long, the lady who answered in nothing but a towel and invited me to join the party. But nothing prepared me for that night. Clock was ticking toward midnight, and dispatch radioed my last run, a large pepperoni with extra cheese to a split-level ranch on the east side, one of those quiet suburbs where the houses all look the same under sodium streetlights. The air was balmy, maybe 70 degrees, with crickets chirping like a bad horror movie soundtrack. I pulled up, grabbed the insulated bag, and hopped out. House looked normal enough. Faded blue siding, a rusty swing set in the yard, porch light buzzing with moths. I knocked, shifting my weight from foot to foot. The door creaked open, and there he was, this massive guy, easily in his 50s, with a beer gut hanging over his sweatpants like a deflated balloon. Gray stubble, bloodshot eyes, and a grin that didn't reach them. "Hey there, pizza girl," he drawled, his voice thick like he'd been hitting the bottle.
"Well, come on in, don't just stand there."
My stomach twisted. Vibes were off from the jump. Something about the way he eyed me, like I was the main course. "Nah, I'm good," I said, holding out the box. "That'll be $18.50. Cash or card?" He chuckled, a wet, rattling sound.
"Oh, come on, it's freezing out here. Don't want to let all the cold air in."
Freezing? It was frickin' summer. Shorts and tank top weather. Sweat beaded on my forehead. But he stepped back, gesturing inside. And, stupid me, I hesitated. My mind raced. What if he complains to the shop? What if I lose the tip? I was new, broke, and, yeah, a little scared of rocking the boat. So I took one step in, just over the threshold, door still ajar behind me.
"No, no, all the way in,"
he insisted, his tone sharpening.
"It's cold out, sweetheart. Close the door."
Heart pounding, I froze. Every instinct screamed run, but panic glued my feet. I muttered, "Oh, okay, fine," and stepped fully inside. He swung the door shut with a click that echoed like a jail cell locking. The screen door latched too. Trapped. I gripped the pizza box like a shield, scanning the room. Holy shit, the living room was a nightmare. stuffed clowns everywhere. Not cute kid stuff, but hundreds of them. Clowns with glassy eyes piled on the couches, spilling off tables. It smelled musty, like mothballs and old sweat. My skin crawled. "Pizza's here, honey," the guy bellowed toward the kitchen. I heard shuffling, and his wife appeared. A woman in a faded house coat, hair in rollers, face pinched like she'd sucked a lemon. She was holding something in her hands, outstretched like an offering. As she got closer, I saw it. A slice of banana bread, steam rising off of it, fresh baked. But why? They just ordered pizza.
"Here, eat this," she said, thrusting it at me. "Banana bread. And don't worry, it's not poisonous."
What the actual f***? My mouth went dry. No thanks, I stammered. I'm on a diet. Can't eat sweets right now. She stared, unblinking, arms still extended.
"Eat it. It's good. Not poisonous, I promise."
"I'm really okay," I said, firmer, backing toward the door. But the husband blocked my path subtly, rummaging in a drawer. Her face twisted.
"Why won't you eat it? I made it special. Eat the damn bread."
She raised her voice, stepping closer, crumbs flaking onto the carpet. Panic surged. "Lady, I said no. I gotta get back to work." I shoved the pizza box at the guy. "Just take it. $18.50. He grabbed it, setting it on a table, buried under some plush toys.
"Hold up. Let me get your tip. Gotta find some change."
"Forget it," I snapped. I don't need it, really."
Nah, you deserve it, pretty thing like you."
He started digging through the couch cushions, tossing bears aside. Quarters clinked, but he kept searching, slow as molasses. Minutes dragged. 2, 3, 5. My phone buzzed in my pocket, probably the shop checking in. Were they stalling? For what? To call someone? To... worse? True crime scenarios flashed. Funny food. Basement dungeons. Headlines about missing girls. "Why is it taking so long?" I demanded, voice shaking. "Just give me whatever and let me go."
"Almost got it,"
he muttered, flipping a pillow. The wife hovered in the kitchen doorway, watching me like prey.
"You sure you don't want that bread? It's homemade."
"Damn, no!" I exploded, done playing nice. "Move! I'm leaving!" He straightened, holding out a handful of quarters, maybe $2.
"Here you go. Drive safe."
I snatched them, yanked the door open, and bolted to my car. Tires squealed as I peeled out, heart slamming against my ribs. Back at the shop, I burst in, breathless.
"Dude, you won't believe this creepy-ass delivery. This weird old guy lured me inside. His wife tried forcing me to eat some not poisonous banana bread. House full of stuffed animals, like a hoarder cult. I thought they were going to kidnap me or something."
My supervisor, this chain-smoking a**hole named Rick, barely looked up from his clipboard.
"Yeah, sounds like the Millers. Weirdos, but harmless. Here's your next run. Double cheese to the apartments on Cascade."
"Harmless? Are you kidding? I could have been murdered!"
He shrugged.
"Tips pay the bills. Get going or clock out."
I slammed the door on my way out, but I finished the shift. Bills don't pay themselves.
My name is Bob. After my divorce, I packed up all of my stuff and moved to a small town, just outside El Paso. I wanted to get away from all the reminders of my old life in Detroit. Because I was retired, I could live anywhere, so I decided to move closer to my oldest son, Blake. Blake lived in the city itself, but I didn't want to deal with all the traffic. My new house was in an isolated community connected to El Paso by one road. It was quiet and safe. The only problem was, I didn't know how to make friends. My neighbors mostly kept to themselves. Blake visited me occasionally, but besides him, I didn't know anyone well enough to invite them over. During one of Blake's visits, I told him my problem. He suggested that I set up a Facebook account to try to find other people into the same kinds of interests as me. He told me about all the Facebook groups that are out there. After Blake left, I set up my profile and started to look for groups that were interested in NASCAR and old westerns, my two favorite things. I was able to find other guys about my age who seemed interesting, but it felt a little weird to be friends with people from other parts of the world. It wasn't a real friendship. So I decided to go local. I found a Facebook group made for the residents of my neighborhood. It had about 50 members, so most of my neighbors were already a part of it. I'm not really good at technology, but this seemed like an easier way to introduce myself than just walking door to door. It took the admin a day to accept me. Once he did, I went through all the group's posts. It seemed like most of the posts were angry complaints about theft in the area. Someone would post about a stolen Amazon package, and then a bunch of other people would comment with similar stories. I was surprised. This seemed like such a quiet neighborhood. I had no idea that there were thieves in the area. I wanted to write a post introducing myself, but I decided not to. The whole group sounded really negative. I didn't check Facebook until a couple of days later. When I did, I saw even more posts about stolen packages. One lady wrote about how her window was broken and someone had snuck in and taken her wallet. That one got a lot of comments. I felt sorry for everyone, but I still wanted to post something. So I wrote a short introduction explaining why I moved here and offering my sympathy for anyone who'd been robbed. I think it sounded pretty nice. I was about to post it when I realized that I should probably add a photo so people could see what I looked like. Most of the photos I had were with Blake, so I posted one from a dinner we had last week. Blake's arm was around my shoulder, and we both looked happy. I sent the post and then turned off my phone. I figured I wouldn't get any responses right away. About an hour later, Blake came over for a surprise visit. He brought a pizza with him. Plus, he had a little housewarming present. I loved my son so much. The present was a cute little wind chime that I could hang in my backyard. It had little glass race cars, which would fit my house perfectly. We sat together and ate our pizza. Blake asked me if I had made any friends, and I told him that I just sent my first post on Facebook, so hopefully I'll meet someone that way. He seemed curious, so he asked to see it. I pulled out my phone and opened Facebook. I was shocked to see that my post had dozens of comments. At first I was excited, but then I read the first comment. "That's him! That's the guy who stole my packages!" I kept reading, and all the other comments were the same. Everyone recognized Blake as the neighborhood thief. I didn't believe it at first, but then I read one of the last comments. "Oh my God! I think he's the one who took my race car wind chime." "Well," Blake said, "can I see?" I realized that he was still waiting to look at my phone. I pulled it away and told him to give me a second. I needed to figure out what to say. He knew that something was wrong, so he reached across the table and grabbed my phone from my hand. As soon as he looked at my screen, he knew he'd been caught. "You weren't supposed to make friends with your neighbors. Why would you do that?" He was acting like this was all my fault. "Blake," I said slowly, "what did you do?" He took a deep breath and explained that living in El Paso was more expensive than he thought. He needed extra help, so he started stealing from my neighborhood. It was the only way he'd be able to survive without losing his apartment. He didn't even have enough money to pay for his meds. "Give me the phone," I said. I was going to call the police. He kept it away from me. My son was 23, so he could overpower me pretty easily. And I didn't want to fight him, of course, but he had to pay for his actions. I told him that I was very disappointed in him. He could have just asked me for money. That was the wrong thing to say. He absolutely freaked out, screaming, "I don't need your help! I'm a grown man!" I backed away from him, scared. His expression went blank, like he was moving on autopilot, and he grabbed the wind chimes off the table. Then he lunged at me, wrapping the wire of the wind chimes around my neck. I tried to tell him to stop, but I couldn't breathe. He squeezed tighter and tighter, screaming, "I'm not a failure! I'm not a failure! I'm not a failure, you fool!" I pushed him, but he wouldn't budge. He was going through an episode, and soon, he'd kill me. There was nothing I could do. And then my front door burst open and two policemen rushed inside. They tackled Blake to the ground and handcuffed him. I pulled the wire off my neck and gasped for breath. I was alive. I watched as they dragged Blake away, kicking and screaming. When we reached the front door, I asked one of the policemen why they came, and he said that my neighbors had called. And sure enough, when I looked out the front door, I saw dozens of people standing on my yard watching the whole thing. As the police shoved Blake into the car, I walked towards my neighbors and explained that I had no idea my son had been terrorizing them for so long. No one said anything. And then all at once, my neighbors walked toward me and wrapped me in a big, comforting group hug. That was the moment I finally felt at home.